Welcome to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. Well, what are you thinking about tonight? You open your mouth and you look and you see some teeth that need attention. Maybe they're yellow and stained, or maybe there's one of them has a cavity that you're just not willing to take care of. There are a lot of things happening in dentistry. We're very fortunate in Chapel Hill to have one of the finest dental schools in the country and to have a whole group of medical students and clinicians, training and research dentists. One of my favorites is Dr. Sam Nesbitt, who's the clinical associate professor in the Department of Diagnostic Sciences and General Dentistry, a renowned teacher, wonderful dentist himself. And Sam, you and I have talked from time to time about these dental issues, and so I just roped you in to come give me a free consult tonight. Welcome.
DG, great to be here. I really appreciate your inviting me to take some time out. And usually I'm used to seeing you in the dental operatory, and that's on my turf, and it's kind of fun to get this role reversal here.
I've got you in the chair, open your mouth and say, ah. Strap you down.
That's great.
Well, that leads me to a question. Sam, you're teaching young dentists and young future dentists in the dental school about treatment opportunities, and one of the things I think we associate with dentistry is that there is from time to time, a high degree of pain. You're able to shoot us up with some relieving medicines, but there have been developments in this, haven't they? What's different from, what are you teaching, or what are the new dentists learning that's different from what you learned when you were coming along?
Well, there are lots of changes in dentistry. Some of it's technological. Things like microscopes have certainly improved the way we do endodontic therapy.
Now, come on now. I have no idea what anodontic therapy is.
Root canals.
I'm really interested in whatever improvement. What do you mean that? Now, just back up and start all over. What anodontic therapy and microscopes? And what in the world do they have to? What's going on here?
Well, if you have a tooth that's badly decayed or a tooth that's fractured and the pulp gets infected, and you need a root canal treatment. In order to get rid of the pain or take care of the infection, they'll go inside the inside of the tooth and clean it out with a series of special instruments, and after they do that, put a special filling in the inside of the tooth.
Okay, now what does a microscope have to do?
Well, a microscope will help you approach it so that you can see all those little nooks and crannies and those little canals, as we call them, on the inside of the tooth.
So this is not a microscope outside the tooth. This is a little tiny microscope that goes in?
It's outside the tooth, but it focuses into the specific opening in the tooth. So when you open things up, you can see the inside of the tooth just magnificently.
Wow. And so what kinds of things could you tell with that kind of device that you wouldn't, that someone who's doing a root canal 20 years ago wouldn't have known about?
Well, it really helps you do a better job of finding the canals and finding your way into the canal system.
So you can do a better cleanup job.
You can do a better cleanup job and therefore a more successful root canal.
So the risk for those of us who are patients is in a root canal. One of the risks is that, notwithstanding due care and a great effort by the dentist, that he or she would miss a little piece of infection that would come back to haunt you later and requiring maybe some more pain and some more redoing of the...
Absolutely correct. Yep.
Well, how do these developments get down into the training of dentists and then to our practitioners? How does that work?
Well, it begins with good research. We've got some great folks at UNC who in many of the fields are lead the efforts in research and can develop some of these new techniques, new materials that help us do a better job of treating our patients and treating them more successfully. And then beyond that, then it's a matter of integrating it into the curriculum and figuring out good ways that we can teach dental students how to use these new techniques and materials in an effective way so that they can do it without having some of those mishaps that you were just sharing with
us. Yeah, well, there are all kinds of interesting things in terms of training stories. And we heard one the other day about the dental school at Chapel Hill, and the story is that 30, 40, 50 years ago, you would only let one left-handed prospective dental student into the class because there was only one left-handed dental chair in the school. And now all of that's because of equipment. It doesn't matter whether they have equipment that you can be left or right-handed.
That's true. We've got a number of chairs in each of our major clinics that are primarily designed for left-handed folks, but under certain circumstances, you can flip all the materials and all the equipment around to the opposite side so that you can work off of either side.
I'm left-handed, and so I have to ask the question: if I run into a left-handed dentist, am I going to be handy, or is he going to be handicapped in his or her ability, to provide treatment to me? Because, like in golf, you know, all the clubs and everything are made for right-handed people, and you're a second-class citizen dentist if you're left-handed?
Absolutely not. Left-handed dentists can do all the same things just as effectively as right-handed dentists. Probably the biggest challenge for a left-handed dentist is getting his or her staff to the point that they're comfortable working from the opposite side of the chair, because typically the dentist is going to be on the patient's right side if they're right-handed, and the assistant is going to be in the left-hand side. And so some of our assistants, like in the faculty practice, where they may be working with 8 or 10 different dentists, they have to learn how to work off of both sides of the chair and do things thinking left brain, right brain. So it takes them a little while to get used to working with left-handed dentists. But beyond that, there are really no differences.
What a
bad question.
Well, no. I mean, that's just I'm left-handed, and I worry about, you know, this total discrimination that those of us who are left-handers experience in this society. What about, Sam, I guess the question that you're probably asked the most among your friends is, what, you know, you've seen a whole variety of different dentists pass through the dental school, and you probably have some ideas about which kinds of people you would choose to be your dentist. I mean, I guess you've had to face that question and had to make those choices. But people must come to you as a professor and say, I like so-and-so, but how should I make a choice of who my dental caregiver should be? You just go in and take what you get?
Well, it's a great question, and I must say I probably don't get asked that question as often as I could or should, but I think it's a fantastic question. Lots of different things to look for. One thing in particular that I think most of our listeners out there can really appreciate is when you go into a new dental office for the first time, I take a look around, make sure that all the staff and the dentist and the whole dental team is using gloves and masks and good hygiene in terms of infection control procedures. Is the office neat? Is it clean? Does it look like they're professional? But beyond that, there are lots of little simple things that I think patients can look forward to and I think should be able to find in this day and age that aren't so obvious, but probably even more important. And that's things like, does your dentist take a really good history when you walk in? In this day and age, with an older population and with many folks taking many more medications than used to be the case, your dentist needs to take the time to make sure that they assess your particular medical history carefully and realize...
Not just your dental history, but your medical history
exactly,
as well.
Exactly, because the medical history...
Now, why is that? Why do you need to get outside the mouth?
Well, the medical history can have a real significant impact on in terms of what type of dental treatment you can do and how you do the dental treatment, and in some cases what pre-medication with perhaps antibiotics would be necessary or important before you have the dental treatment done.
Can you illustrate? I mean, like what?
Sure. A classic case is a patient that's had a history of mitral valve prolapse or a heart murmur, and they come into the dental office, and with certain types of heart murmurs, they need to have antibiotics before certain types of what we would call invasive dental procedures. And if they don't get those antibiotics before the dental procedures, there is a possibility that they could develop a life-threatening heart infection as a result of that.
There was a 8 or 10 years ago, I guess, a real prominent lawsuit involving some great dentists and some great patients about this. And help me if this rings a bell for me, because the one of the legal questions was whether or not the patient had been careful enough in revealing to the the dentist the history of a potential valve, heart valve problem or heart disease, and the other was whether the dentist had been careful enough in asking the question to the patient. And it could have, but it turned out that we learned from that this could be a life-threatening situation. But is it a common situation, or is this just
surprisingly so? Probably about 15% of the population has that condition of mitral valve prolapse that we just talked about.
And it was, so you don't have to give me the total lecture, but those words don't mean anything. That this is in the valve in the heart has got what's going wrong with it. What's wrong with it?
And with the mitral valve prolapse, when the heart valve leaflets close, they don't close completely. So when you're listening to the heart, it makes a clicking sound or a whooshing sound that's somewhat different from what the normal heart valve closure sound makes.
All right, so if you're providing dental care to someone who has that condition, what, and you know that, what risk do you, what precautions do you take in treating this patient versus what you would do in treating a patient where this risk was not disclosed or was not did not make itself manifest?
Well, some of the classic things, again, are to use good infection control techniques, but also to provide the patient with appropriate antibiotics before the treatment. And the rationale for that is, so the bacteria from the mouth, when they are introduced into the bloodstream, if you have the antibiotic on board, it'll then kill off those bacteria before they have a chance to colonize or grow on the heart valves.
So the heart valves, if it is just a wide open place for bacteria to assemble, and particularly the kinds of bacteria that are in the mouth, is that what happens?
That's correct.
And is this a risk if I just go in for a filling or just for teeth cleaning or for any kind of dental treatment, or has it got to be something more serious?
Again, great question. Tooth filling normally would not require the antibiotic prior to the dental treatment, because the risk of introducing bacteria into the bloodstream with a routine filling is extremely low. But on the other hand, any extractions, anytime you do a tooth cleaning, with both of those procedures, there's a significant chance of introducing high numbers of bacteria into the bloodstream and therefore leaving the patient at risk.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you if there's anything other than the heart valve problems that you need antibiotics for when you're visiting your dentist. Dr. Sam Nesbitt, professor at the University of North Carolina Dental School, and I will be right back.
And now, here's Deborah Miller from A Southern Season.
From our legendary Tar Heels to our incomparable quality of life, our hometown pride is evident at every turn. Named one of America's outstanding retailers at the International Fancy Food Show, we're bursting at the seams with award-winning gifts of good taste, glorious flavors, and gustatory delights. Our family of customers extends far and wide, but we wouldn't even think of calling anywhere else home.
A Southern Season, Chapel Hill's landmark gourmet emporium at University Mall.
This is Catherine Clark, real estate broker with Tony Hall & Associates Real Estate. I'd like to wish everyone a Happy New Year, and I hope 2006 is your best year ever. This time of year often gets people thinking about New Year's resolutions. My resolution this year is similar to years past, to continue to build my real estate business one client at a time. My goal isn't to sell the most houses, it's to have the happiest clients. I believe in good old-fashioned hard work and in providing the highest quality customer service to each and every one of my clients. I always know when I'm doing a good job for my clients because they tell me that I made them feel like they were my only client, even when they were not. All realtors are not the same. Call me, Catherine Clark, at 933-8500 to find out how my hard work will pay off for you. Whatever your New Year's resolution may be, I wish you all the best in succeeding in 2006.
If you could take a safe and effective pill to cure your anxiety about going to the dentist for that cleaning or major dental treatment, why wouldn't you? Sunrise Dental offers sedation dentistry for those who want their beautiful smile back but are nervous about the procedure. Just one pill, 1 hour before someone brings you to Sunrise Dental. You'll feel nothing and have little or no memory of the treatment. Sedation Dentistry at Sunrise Dental, Franklin Street in Chapel Hill and Spring Forest Road in Raleigh. For more information, call Sunrise Dental at 929-3996.
Now that the holiday season is over, it's time to redecorate your home. You can start now. Visit the Giant Silk Sale at University Florist on East Franklin Street and Botanica at University Square. During the month of January, University Florist and Botanica are having a huge silk flower sale. All silk orchids and green plants at 25% off and silk flowers by the stem at 30% off. Visit University Florist today at 124 East Franklin Street or Botanica at University Square.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're visiting with one of the legendary professors in the University of North Carolina School of Dentistry. Great teacher and a great dentist himself. He's answering some of the questions I've always had about new developments in dentistry. And Sam, when we took a break, you'd explain to us how bacteria getting loose in the mouth during dental treatment might make its way to the heart valve and set up a series of infections that could be life-threatening. Mm-hmm. So when you're selecting a dentist, you'd like to have one who's going to ask you that question. Mm-hmm. To show the care that this dentist has to be sure that you're not going to get into some kind of treatment that would obviously be life-threatening. Now, with respect, but before we get back to the selection of the dentist, now I'm curious, if the bacteria gets loose, what other kind of condition might it exacerbate?
Well,
dangerously.
Several other medical issues that would be a concern for. If the patient's got advanced liver disease, advanced kidney disease, any condition which really compromises their immune response would be one that you might at least need to consider the probability or possibility of taking antibiotics before invasive dental treatment. But the other main issue that a lot of folks really need to be concerned about, DG, is when folks have had arthritis or serious joint problems and they need to have a joint replacement. So particularly individuals who have had a hip replacement or a knee replacement, those folks are generally considered, at least for the first 2 years after the surgery, to be at high risk for secondary infection. Not in this case for heart disease, but for secondary infection at the joint site.
So around the where the surgery had
exactly.
Disturbed the existing pattern, then that would be a place where bacteria could colonize and create an infection due to the
right.
In part due to the dental work that somebody. So if somebody comes, go into the dentist office or new dentist, and he says, you know, he goes down his or her checklist and says, have you had joint replacements? Don't jump on that person and say, why would you ask? But know that that's a careful. What other things should you look for in a dentist other than this careful medical, seemingly a medical history?
Well, one thing I would really encourage folks to look for is a dentist that does a thorough head and neck examination. In other words, do they look at the structures underneath the jaws, in and around the mouth? Now, do they look carefully at the cheeks, at the palate, at the soft palate, underneath the tongue? Are they checking for lymph nodes, lumps and bumps and bulges and abnormalities that may show up, again, on a careful examination?
Now, in training new dentists, is this the kind of examination that you give every time somebody comes in for treatment or just on the initial or... you can't give a full examination every time a patient comes to see you.
That's certainly true. But for an initial exam, when you go to see a dentist for the first time, except perhaps if it were for emergency treatment only, I would expect that the dentist would go ahead and go through that process that we've just described.
All right, now here's the question. Here's a problem. Mm-hmm. You're going to give us some more things about selecting a dentist. What you've said is... you ought to select a dentist who gives you this careful examination, and you go, And he or she gives you an examination that maybe doesn't meet that criteria, but now you're that person's patient, and you got to break the dentist-patient relationship because you weren't satisfied. How can you kind of check up in advance on this?
Probably the best thing to do is word of mouth. Talk with your friends, talk with neighbors, talk with other folks who have gone to a certain dentist or dental practice, and see what their experience has been like with that dental team. That's a real good way to find out what the typical experience is like.
You say there are other things that you'd get, if you were asked for this advice, other mm-hmm. things that you would advise people to take into account when you make the selection of your dentist?
Well, we've talked about some things that are pretty specific to look for, but there are also some human relations things that I think are real, real important as well. Does the dentist listen to you? When you go into the dental office, especially for that first time, does the dentist take the time to really carefully listen to what are your concerns? What are your goals? Oral health care now is more than just putting in fillings. And any dentist at this stage of the game, if they're really interested in their patients, and we hope we all are, should be listening carefully to see what your particular issues and concerns are.
So those two things, a careful history and a consideration. Now, what about a skill level? How do you check on the skill level of your prospective dentist? Is there any way to do that?
That's a tough one. But again, talking with friends, neighbors, relatives, what's their experience been like when they have fillings put in? Do they have rough edges and have trouble with floss catching and breaking on the edges of those fillings? When they have crowns put in, do the crowns stay in, or do they come out? Under certain circumstances, it's always expected that a crown may loosen up over a number of years, but is it a routine thing or is it an unusual thing?
Well, here's where I think you're taking me, but I want you to correct me if I'm wrong. And that is that I think you're saying that the skill level of dentists in this community and really throughout, because of the work that you all do with the dentists that you train, is generally pretty high, and therefore at least one of the most important factors is how do you get along with this person, and how do you all deal together? Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
I think that's true. With rare exceptions, most dentists are certainly going to be able to provide a competent level of oral health care for their patients. And the dividing line in many cases is going to be, again, how well do you relate to that particular dentist? Now, just as patients are all different, some patients appreciate a very straightforward, technical, direct approach, and other patients are going to appreciate, if you will, shall we say, a little more warm, fuzzy, communicative approach to things. And so there's not going to be any one dentist that's going to be the best for every patient. And I think we all, as dentists, certainly appreciate that there's some patients that we handle better than other patients.
Let's talk about some specific things that people worry about with their mouths. This is so, I don't know, getting old is just kind of a real wonderful experience. But things happen, I think, in your mouth. And one of the things I noticed about old people, including myself, is that there's more difficulty in keeping your breath fresh. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And are good dental hygiene habits, can they help, or is this just kind of a lost cause?
Oh, it's certainly not a lost cause. And there are lots of things that the typical patient, the typical listener can do. And obviously, as you suggested, good brushing, flossing, just maintaining a good oral, healthy oral condition, I should say, goes a long way toward keeping fresh breath. Beyond that, though, there are some things that you raise related to age, particularly. As we all get older and we're taking more medications, and there are lots of medications out there like blood pressure medications and antihistamines and many others that will tend to dry out the mouth and reduce the salivary flow. And when that happens, it changes the balance of the normal bacteria or microbes or bugs in the mouth, And that, in some cases, can contribute to
unleashes the whole host of bad breath bacteria that are unchecked by the normal processes in the mouth. Is that? I mean, that's just poetry, but that doesn't really happen.
To some extent, that's true. but again, it can be overcome with just good brushing and flossing and maintaining things well.
One of the things I think that has kind of startled me about the mouth. And when I was growing up, if somebody lost a tooth, it was pretty much all over. Maybe put in something. If you lost a lot of teeth, as people my age back then were prone to do, it was just a set of false teeth. But now, you know, I read about these implants. Mm-hmm. Is that a realistic alternative for all of us? If we lose a good tooth, can you fix me up, just put me in a replacement without
only realistic, it's becoming the standard of care. If we go back 10, 15 years ago, the standard of care was to put in, typically, if it was one tooth that was missing and you had a tooth in front of it and a tooth behind it, a bridge or a fixed partial denture, as we call it. But now putting in an implant is much more predictable. The prognosis is better. There are fewer problems. And the likelihood that you're going to have it 15, 20, 25 years down the road is much greater than the probable likelihood that you'd be able to have the bridge in the mouth for that same length of time.
Well, tell me about the implant, what happens, and then whether or not this is something that a specialist has to handle or that you could go to to a local, just any dentist can do.
Well, an implant replacement typically has three parts. The one part is the equivalent of the root of the dental tooth, and it's typically made out of titanium, and it's somewhat of a screw formation, but it's placed into the bone, usually...
Into your jawbone.
Your jawbone, that's correct. Usually by a specialist, but doesn't necessarily have to be the case, and now more and more general dentists are even getting to the point where they're feeling comfortable doing implant placements. But up until now, typically an oral and maxillofacial surgeon or a periodontist would be the one placing the implant fixture. And then on top of the fixture, you have the post portion, or what we call the abutment. And then finally, on the top is the cap or the crown that rests on that that abutment, and that gets cemented to place. And typically, the abutment and the crown are placed by a prosthodontist, which is a reconstruction specialist, or a general dentist.
So it's a complicated, still a fairly complex procedure, and an expensive one, I guess.
Unfortunately, it is still fairly expensive, probably in the neighborhood of $2,800 to $3,000.
So just because I don't like my stained teeth, I'm not going to go get all of them replaced with implants yet.
I certainly would not recommend it, right?
Well, Sam Nesbitt, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back to talk more about what Dr. Nesbitt and his colleagues at the UNC School of Dentistry are teaching new dentists and how that's going to have an impact on our dental care. We'll be right back.
This is Kit Ballew of Franklin Street Realty.
And I'm Sammy Martin. Kit, let's play word association with basketball and real estate, like, say, dribble.
Easy. What your kitchen faucet starts to do the morning the home inspector comes over. Okay, I've got one. You gotta give 110%.
Well, that's what it feels like your realtor said when you asked what it would cost to list your house.
I don't know of a better time to say, you get what you pay for. Although 110% is a bit high.
I have a true story, though. My neighbor talked to me at length, but eventually listed with one of the discount firms in town.
Thinking he would save some money?
Right. But it sold over the asking price in 4 days, but for $30,000 less than I thought it was worth. 9 months later, the buyers resold it for $43,000 more than they paid.
I think the listeners can do the math. For real service, call Franklin Street Realty at 929-7174. Or find us on the web at franklinstreetrealty.com.
Franklin Street Realty. Why would you call anyone else?
The High and Rubish Insurance Agency is an independent insurance agency serving our community for over 40 years. Why should you work with an independent agent? Because an independent agent works for you, not a big insurance company. Now is the time to be sure that you have the right insurance coverage for you and your family. So call High and Rubish for your free insurance review. High and Rubish will assess your insurance needs and make sure you have the coverage you need. Many of the insurance reviews High and Rubish completes result in no insurance change. Isn't that reassuring? Wouldn't you like to be sure you're covered? You have nothing to lose and everything to gain by calling High and Rubish today for your free insurance review. Call 913-1144, 913-1144, or stop by 6015 Farrington Road in Chapel Hill. High and Rubish Insurance, when you need to be sure.
Trying to get a Frazier screen, couldn't. Works right now, long outside shot, good! Oh my goodness!
Imagine what would happen if coaching decisions were made at a corporate office somewhere else. Games are won and lost on the court, and like banking, a positive outcome depends on quick, responsive decision-making. I'm Larry Loser, President and CEO of Harrington Bank. We're building a winning tradition at Harrington Bank and invite you to come experience the difference when your bank is locally owned and operated. Harrington Bank, you deserve banking like this.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360, WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Professor Sam Nisbet, Dr. Sam Nisbet, great dentist and a great teacher. And he's telling us some of the things that you tell your friends about dentistry when they sit you down and ask you about it. We've talked about some of the new developments when we took a break. You talked about implants. Great development, still expensive. Mm-hmm. Sam, lots of things have happened in technology, new techniques of x-rays and the mm-hmm. replacements for x-rays, a whole new way in which we can use chemicals and other things to take care of some people's yellow whitening devices, technology in terms of the electronic records keeping so you can keep up with your patients and mm-hmm. keep up with kinds of treatment, new chemicals, new compounds to use as fillings and in your treatment plan. So here's the question. What, in your mind, has been the technological development since you've been practicing that has enabled you and your colleagues to improve care the most? Is there a signal technological development that you could point to?
Well, in terms of tooth replacement, the implants that we just were talking about, without a doubt, that has radically changed the way we do dentistry and the way we treat implant patients. And probably has been the biggest change in the last 10 years or so. To look at it from a broader perspective, though, there's a much more subtle change that I think in the long run is probably going to mean more than any other, at least in some respects. And that's the whole way we look at dental treatment. How effective is it? From a healthcare standpoint, we've got two main diseases that we've dealt with in dentistry: periodontal disease or gum disease, and what we call dental caries or cavities. And we're getting a much better understanding of both of those processes, and we're getting a much better understanding, and I think taking a very healthy step back in terms of the therapy that we've used for many, many years to treat those primary diseases, even to the point of asking questions like, do we really have to treat this disease for this particular patient?
Give me an illustration of where you might ask that question.
Well, certainly 10 or 15 years ago, the standard axiom in most dental schools and with most dentists as well was that if a patient were missing a first molar, for example, a major biting tooth in the back of the mouth, that we'd have to replace it. We were concerned that there are a number of different bad things that would happen. Joint problems, collapsed bite.
If you did replace it or didn't replace it.
If you did not replace it. If you did not replace it. Gum disease, changes in the bone shape, possibility of further infection and deterioration. And with some really forward-thinking studies by some of my colleagues, like Dan Sugars and Jim Bader, looking at large populations base, or large population bases, I should say, we've come to realize that some of these old things that we thought were so true and so good in dentistry, at least for some patients, aren't really necessary at all.
So you have a group of colleagues here at the dental school who are involved in research that is challenging the assumptions on which the treatment, that which current treatment is based.
Exactly.
In other words, I mean, I don't want to put it this way, but you might be doing something in terms of your counseling today that we will learn 20 years from now based on widespread research that might not have, you know, might not have been totally correct.
Absolutely. I think that
sort of sets apart academic medicine from the kind of care that we are that we might get both from medical practitioners and from dentists who are so certain that what they say is correct, and we have to rely on them, but it might not always turn out to be right. What you talk about, the strategy about replacing a particular important tooth, you might now say, I'm not too sure that we want to replace this. Is that sort of what you'd say? Because
that's correct. That's correct. What they've
and how would you talk to me as a patient? And I've got I'm missing this tooth, and and you're saying, all right, you may want to replace it, but here are the consequences, or you may not want to. And here are the how do you counsel me?
DG, we've got some options here. We've got a missing tooth. And there are some bad things that could happen, such as your teeth getting malaligned or turned or twisted or rotated if we don't replace that missing tooth. It might change your bite. You might have some joint problems with that. But our best evidence is that those outcomes are not necessarily going to happen. And in the first 1 to 2 years, if those teeth don't move, chances are they are not going to move further on down the road. And so what we might want to do here, and I offer it to you as at least one possible approach, we could measure the space between those two teeth and carefully check from time to time and see if that space is collapsing or changing. And if it's not changing, you may decide to use that money that you otherwise would put into an implant into a new mega TV set or another payment on your car. And I could tell you in all honesty that you're not necessarily going to be doing yourself a disservice by
doing
that.
Well, that'd be nice. And then I know what most of your patients say, or I'd say, well, what would you do? And then what do you answer? Okay.
That's a tough one because you really need to put yourself in the patient's shoes in order to be able to do that. And for a patient who's relatively young in their 20s or 30s, I probably would recommend putting in that implant, replacing that missing tooth, knowing that that tooth is going to give them additional function and not only prevent...
Prorated over a long period of time. When you're talking to somebody like me, the proration of it over each year is not significant, is going to be so high that you just say maybe you want to pass
you
it by.
You are so astute.
All right, well, let's take a quick break. Dr. Sam Nisbett from the UNC Dental School and I are talking about dental treatment. He and I will be right back.
WCHL 1360, time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins, brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners community.
Within a day of being born, she was already a celebrity in Canada. Her story next on Biography for Radio.
Why shop at Borders for holiday gifts? Let's compare.
I thought this wet-dry vac would be perfect for you because you impress me as a person who will vacuum in any condition.
Or,
I thought this James Patterson novel would be perfect for you because you impress me as a person of mystery and intrigue.
At Borders, you'll find hundreds of thoughtful gifts for under $10. Borders, open up a season of surprises.
It was June 1st, 1967, and Canada had just turned 100 years old. The first Canadian to be born that day was a baby girl in Ladysmith, British Columbia. It was an auspicious start. As a teenager, she was nothing special. She wore braces, played the saxophone, and excelled in sports. In 1988, she was at a football game when the roving eye of a television camera flashed her smile on the big screen. The crowd erupted. She was wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with the logo of Canadian brewer Labatt's. The company saw its chance and hired her to promote its beer. She was then discovered by Playboy magazine. The publicity set off her television career with the role in the TV comedy Home Improvement, and then the smash hit drama series that brought her fame worldwide. But with celebrity also came pain. In 1998, she accused her rock star husband of abuse. Later, she was plagued by a stalker and found to have caught hepatitis C from a tattoo needle. Her troubles, however, have done little to tarnish her popularity. For many, she will always remain the deliciously watchable lifeguard C.J. Parker on the Baywatch television series. Actress Pamela Anderson. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by The Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at The Cedars of Chapel Hill.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. D.G. Martin talking to Sam Nesbitt. We're talking about the whole realm of dental education, treatment, research, all these kinds of things. And Sam, something that really shocked me the other day was when you said something about being careful about drinking soda, about drinking sort of carbonated drinks as a hazard for my teeth. That's new. For me, is that? But it's not really. You should have told me about this a long time ago. What is the risk about drinking Coca-Colas or Pepsi-Colas or something?
Well, part of it is conventional wisdom. We've known for many, many, many years, and I think most of our listeners out there would be well aware of the fact that typical sodas, soft drinks, pop has a lot of sugar in it. And that, obviously, from a decay point, has been a problem.
Okay, no, of course we know about the sugar and the risk, or many of us know about that, but there's something else, isn't there?
That's right. Now, over the last, say, 10 years, what we've seen is a drastic increase in the average consumption of carbonated beverages. And with that, we're seeing a lot more of what we now know is dental erosion. Basically, it's acid wear on the outside surface of the teeth. And interestingly enough, those folks who have switched to diet beverages, diet sodas, thinking that they were doing themselves a favor because they weren't going to get decay, have inadvertently caused themselves a real problem because of the low pH, the acid in those diet beverages. In truth, the diet beverages often have a lower pH, more acidity than their conventional counterparts.
Now, does the acidity come from the carbonation? Is that it, or is it something else? I mean, if I let the drinks fizzle out so that they're not carbonated anymore, does that eliminate the risk, or are there other things in there?
It's the either citric acid or the phosphoric acid that the manufacturers typically add to the beverage in order to balance the taste. It's a taste issue.
So it's something in there, notwithstanding the carbonation. It's something
Correct.
Else in there. Now, what you talk about this erosion, that means eating up my teeth.
Exactly.
Is it just an enamel problem, or is it go to the function of the teeth? Are they going to eat away? Or
it can uniformly peel away or melt away that outer enamel layer on the teeth.
That beautiful white part of the teeth.
The beautiful white part of the teeth.
Down into the, yeah, that might be, that you get into the yellowing.
Exactly.
Is that white.
Exactly.
Risk. So, but not life-threatening.
No,
is that right?
Certainly not life-threatening.
Is it just
but
an appearance matter, or is it go to the health of the tooth itself? Do you increase the risk of cavities, or is it, what's the consequence?
The main consequence is if it continues over years and decades, and typically our teenage kids that are consuming large volumes of these sodas over many, many, many years, the teeth get thinner and thinner and thinner, and sometimes become more and more sensitive and more discolored, and ultimately the only good solution may be to put caps or crowns on virtually all their teeth, which is expensive, time-consuming, and obviously something that if it can be avoided, we'd much rather avoid.
Well, so maybe in addition to warning labels on cigarettes and alcohol products, we better put the warning on sodas, Cokes and Pepsis.
Watch it.
This may
be,
this may be dangerous to your teeth.
I wish we could.
Is that right? Anything else in terms of what you see going on in the way people are conducting their lives that complicates their hope for good dental, for a good dental outcome? If you could say one or two things to people, do this or don't do this, other than don't drink too many Coca-Colas, what else?
Well, the age-old good recommendations to brush, floss, for folks who have a tendency to get cavities or decay, going ahead and using fluoride rinses and fluoride products, make sure they're using a fluoridated toothpaste or dentifrice. Those are all good recommendations. For folks who have a high decay rate, some other things that we realize now are really helpful would be chewing gum with a xylitol. And I emphasize the xylitol-based chewing gum.
Well, Sam Nesbitt, those are all wonderful suggestions. Now that I've got you going, I've got to tell you we've run out of time. We'll just have to get you back. This has been great. Thanks for coming to give us a free dental consult. Thanks for what you're doing in training the great new dentist who are available to take care of us on a day-to-day basis. And what a great asset you and your colleagues at the dental school are for those of us who live in this area.
DG, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Thanks to all y'all. Thanks for Jeff Hamlin for taking care of us tonight. Appreciate all of y'all listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
At work, in the car. News Talk 1360, WCHL, Chapel Hill, Carrboro's News Talk and Tar Heel Station.